It's reported that the total number of terrorists is only a portion of the total number of Islamic extremists, which itself is but a tiny portion of the total number of Muslims. So how can one automatically attribute Islam to terrorism? Islam is a religion that has some 1.5 billion followers, most of which seem to be peaceful people. We ask tonight, is Islam a violent religion, as its critics have claimed, or is it a religion of compassion, as most Muslims would argue? Is it the radical Islamic movement in the Arab world, and more recently in Europe as well, which shapes our view on Islam? Doctrines of jihad and holy war are preached by so-called radical Muslims, but from where are they getting these doctrines? How are they interpreting them? Are radicals intimidating and silencing the moderates? Or does the term radical even exist in Islam? When we consider the question of whether Islam has been hijacked and is dominated by radicals, many argue to look into to look to the terms of absolute numbers and in terms of prominence. Well, how do we arrive at the truth about Islam? I'm sure tonight's panel can shed some light on these questions. We welcome you to Jihad Exposed, where tonight's question of the evening is, has Islam been hijacked by radicals? And it's my pleasure this evening to introduce our four panelists of the evening. Our first guest is Dr. Daniel Pipes, director of the Middle East Forum, a think tank that promotes American interests in the Middle East and protects the constitutional order from Middle Eastern threats. A former official in the U.S. Department of State, he has taught at the University of Chicago, Harvard University, the U.S. Naval War College, and Pepperdine University. Mr. Pipes is the author of 12 books on the Middle East, Islam, and other political topics. Pipes has also received two presidential appointments, has testified before many congressional committees, and has served on five presidential campaigns. Also with us, we have Robert Spencer, director of Jihad Watch, an organization dedicated to bringing public attention to the role that jihad theology and ideology plays in the modern world and to correcting popular misconceptions about the role of jihad and religion in modern-day conflicts. Spencer is the author of 10 books, including the New York Times bestsellers The Truth About Muhammad and The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Crusades. He's also led seminars on Islam and jihad for the U.S. Central Command, U.S. Army Command and General Staff College, the U.S. Army's Asymmetric Warfare Group, the FBI, the Joint Terrorism Task Force, and the U.S. Intelligence Committee. Our third guest of this evening, we have Imam Mustafa Zayed, a member of the Scientific Board of Quran and Sunnah Research of Cairo. He speaks widely in interfaith settings with a devotion to bridging peace between the major religions and communities. Zayed is author of several books, including The Lies About Muhammad, and is a leading teacher in the Islamic Society of Central Jersey. Imam Zayed was featured as one of 10 North American Islamic scholars on a British documentary entitled Islam in America. And last but not least, we have Abdullah Kundi with us, a Muslim apologist joining us live from Australia. He's participated in many debates with Christian scholars on subtopics relating to Islam and Christianity. He's undertaken studies in Islam with Sheikh Abdul Mawiz Navdi and Sheikh Wissam Shekhawi. He's completed studies in history and science at the University of Sydney and is currently studying medicine. Again, we welcome you this evening to Jihad Exposed. And tonight's topic, tonight's question is, how has Islam been hijacked, if it has been hijacked by radicals? And before we get into the details of tonight's topic, we should probably first define what we mean by the terms hijacked and radicals under the context of Islam. So, Robert, if you can sort of give us a brief overview, when someone claims that Islam has been hijacked, what are they talking about here? Because it almost gives the notion that more than one form of Islam exists.
Well, certainly more than one form of Islam does exist. There are various sects, the Sunnis and the Shia most famously, as well as the various schools of jurisprudence. And they do have various disagreements, although none of them are very large. Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, famously is supposed to have said that his community will not agree on error, and there are no huge or major disagreements between the various groups. But there are differences. The problem when it comes to whether the religion has been hijacked or not, the claim is being made in saying that Islam fundamentally teaches peace and tolerance, harmony between peoples, and the idea of peaceful coexistence as equals with unbelievers. And the idea then comes from that the people who are committing violence in the name of Islam are somehow getting it wrong, twisting its teachings, misunderstanding them and misapplying them. And then they would be termed the radicals, whereas those who are following the allegedly true and peaceful teachings would be termed the moderates. This is kind of a strange distinction, really, because a radical in general is someone who just does something very fanatically or tenaciously, but not someone who generally gets it all wrong. You know, people don't say that communist radicals are misunderstanding communism or misapplying its teachings. They're just very serious about carrying them out. And when it comes to radical Muslims, one would think ordinarily, well, they're just the people who take it most seriously and are carrying it out. But instead, we're told that, no, they're getting it all wrong. They're misunderstanding it. And so the question really can be solved simply by looking at the Quran and looking at the teachings of Muhammad as set out in the Hadith. And those things will show us whether Islam really teaches peace or warfare against unbelievers, and what kind of peace and what kind of warfare and so on. And these questions can be objectively verified simply by going to the canonical texts and teachings of Islam.
And right now I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Pipes. You mentioned that there's three interpretations of Islam. If you can take us through those as well as what your view is on that.
I'm sorry, what are you referring to with the three?
You've said that there are three interpretations or three views on Islam, the establishment view, the insurgent view, and the middle position view, which I believe is what you hold. If you could sort of help our audience understand a little more about that.
Right. My point is that in the United States, maybe more broadly in the West today, one finds three different understandings of what the nature of the problem is. What I call the establishment view is that there has been a hijacking of Islam, that the problem is extremism, right? The problem is Al-Qaeda, anything but mention Islam. The other two reads on Islam, one says that the problem is Islam as such. The religion of Islam is in itself naturally aggressive, terrorist, and so forth. And there's nothing, in other words, will be that between those two, which I focus not on Islam as such, but on a reading of Islam. You can call it radical Islam, or Islamism, or fundamentalist Islam, totalitarian Islam, political Islam, whatever one names it, it is a form of it. It's not the only understanding of it. And in this reading, it is, in some profound sense, Islam, but it's a version of it, indeed a modern version. There are historical precedents for Islamism, but Islamism is a modern phenomenon. It is transforming the religion of Islam into an ideology like socialism, communism. And that is something modern, something historical, something that I say has, when I began studying Islamic topics in the late 1960s, Islamism was virtually moribund. It had no great importance today. It is the number one strategic threat to the United States. So it has grown, and if it can grow, it can, of course, also decline. And my goal is to have this form of Islam be crushed, just as fascism was crushed in World War II, and communism was defeated in this Cold War. Now Islamism is the enemy, and it must be defeated. It's akin to saying, I want to defeat a certain kind of German, a certain kind of Russian, not all Germans, not all Russians, but the fascist, the communist, and the Islamist.
Thank you for that introduction. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to Imam Mustafa as we're, again, introducing the topic. For those of you just joining us, our question of the night is, has Islam been hijacked by radicals, Muslim radicals, that is? Imam Mustafa, if you could sort of take us through the interpretation process of Islam by a Muslim who carries out acts of terrorism under the name of Islam, if you could sort of take us through what thought process processes they're going through.
Well, actually, I think we go back a little bit to the title because that's going to help us. You cannot hijack Islam. Islam is the religion of one quarter of the population on the planet. There's one holy book that is the Quran for Muslims in the same original language. That is a life language. As it was revealed to Prophet Muhammad 1400 years ago by Archangel Gabriel, the most quoted man in history is Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and the most biographed man in history is the Prophet. So Islam itself, if you want to know anything about Islam, it cannot be more accessible at any time of history than it is right now. So for someone to deviate, for someone to commit a crime, and he has a has a Muslim name that he carries, and whatever that he claims as a criminal has absolutely no bearing on Islam itself because the reference is right there. The real hijacking that happened is hijacking the image of Islam in the West. And that happened by radicals in the West who try to take the crimes of the few, the crimes of the people that God only knows who finance him and who makes their horrible crimes that easy, like the 19 of the horrible crimes of September 11th, and make it a crime that is stamped on the forehead of every Muslim in the West and the 1.6 billion people out there, taking extremes of the hit and cry tactic or the swift boarding of people where, as you just heard, Islam being the law is to be judged by the behavior of criminals or whatever radicals they call, not that the criminals themselves would be judged by Islamic law. For example, the biggest punishment and the highest punishment in Islamic law, Sharia law, that they scare people with is for terrorists. These people that committed the crimes of September 11th, had they been caught by Islam and prosecuted in an Islamic court of law, they would have been executed in public in a way to make an example of them.
Right, but
is not the crime of Islam. The crime is the crime of criminals.
Okay, but again, if you could just somebody that considers themselves a Muslim that carries out such acts of violence, why do we see them take out those acts of violence? Why do we see acts of terrorism being carried out only under the name of Islam? Why are they taking verses themselves and justifying their actions like that?
I'll ask you the same question. Joe Stack, a patriotic American born and raised in America who belongs to the Tea Party, just hated the IRS for whatever reason, whatever ideology, took a plane and smashed it, killing himself in a suicide mission into the IRS building in Texas. No one considered what kind of ideology that he belongs to, if he's a Christian, what kind of faction of Christianity, and who has an effect upon them. And some people would not even call it a terrorist act. Someone in Pennsylvania the other day, a couple months ago, took a machine gun, went into a gym, and killed 13 people for that they have committed.
Okay, because we have to just keep it. So what you're saying is we see these acts of violence or terrorism being carried out, but they have nothing whatsoever to do with Islam. Yet they're Muslims that we see.
In Islam. Okay. And the big mistake that we make is that we make the criminal the ideologue. The criminal is a criminal. If you go to any jail, everyone is innocent.
Okay.
So you want to believe the criminals? Are they credible? If you want to judge them, let's look at Islamic law and see the punishment of indiscriminate killing of innocent people. There's no higher punishment in Islam.
Okay, we will turn it over back to Robert and Daniel in a few minutes. But I first let's turn it over to Abdullah to give him an opportunity to speak. If it's true that Islam has been hijacked, like many people claim, if that's true, how come 1.5 million or billion Muslims couldn't protect Islam from such a minority of radicals that have seemed to have hijacked the religion itself? Why couldn't they have saved the religion from this small minority?
So, Salman, just to clarify your question, you're saying that why couldn't the majority of Muslims being in vast greater numbers save the hijacking from the minority? Is that what you're asking?
Yes. If it's true that Islam has been hijacked.
Look, I guess, the first thing that I would say is that Islam has been no more hijacked than Christianity has been hijacked. you know, we don't need to look beyond the United States of America to see numerous terrorist attacks, not only carried out by Christians, but actually in the name of Christianity. Eric Rudolph would be a prime example. The multiple Christian groups that have blown up abortion clinics and murdered doctors that facilitate abortion. So, I mean, I would take it even further than Mustafa in saying that there are terrorists whose specific ideology that they relate to aren't considered by the mainstream media, and say that, in fact, we have a very, very large proportion of terrorist attacks committed by Christians as well. Now, having said that, do I then say, well, all Christians are terrorists, or Christianity is a terrorist ideology, or anything along those sorts of lines? Well, of course I don't. And likewise, that's what we would expect from competent journalists, from competent media commentators such as Daniel and Robert. But I think at the moment we're not really getting it. And there's a large market, a large amount of money to be made by people like Daniel, by people like Robert, by people like Ayan Hirsi Ali, by people like Geert Wilders, that just like to demonize Muslims and demonize Islam, and have various media organizations then throw cash and sponsorship at them.
Right, but okay, before we, I'd like to turn it to Robert, but just a quick follow-up question. You turned it to Christianity. Tonight's topic is, has Islam been hijacked by radicals? So I want to focus on Islam, not necessarily Christianity, because the notion out, there's no notion out there that Christianity has been hijacked. It's Islam has been hijacked, and we're trying to debate that tonight. So I guess, did you have a specific answer on why, if it's true that Islam has been hijacked, why the majority Muslims could not have protected it from those radicals?
I'm not trying to set up a tactic and say Christians are also committing terrorist attacks, and therefore they need to be considered, you know, as terrorists in the way that Muslims are. What I'm saying is that we need to look at things in their real perspective. We need to look at global points of view, not just merely fine needle points of view. And indeed, you know, I mean, I think the mere question itself, has Islam been hijacked, as I was trying to illustrate, is loaded and incorrect. And it's no more correct to pose that question than it is for me to pose the same question about any other religion. I'm not specifically choosing Christianity because this is a Christian channel. I was choosing Christianity because this is a channel based in the United States, and that's the predominant religion there. So I don't think that I'm trying to misdirect and demonize Christianity. I'm just trying to illustrate that the question itself is problematic.
Okay, let's turn it back over to Robert for some follow-up comments, but also if you can help us understand, if Muslims, there are some Muslims out there that are concerned, genuinely concerned, that their religion has been hijacked by radicals. I don't want to say any names, but there are certain individuals out there that carry out acts of terrorism under the name of Islam. Why do we see, for those Muslims here in the West, why do we see a general silence to stand up against people like Osama bin Laden, for example, or who, you know, his followers? Why do we see, are there intimidation tactics because of that? Or, I mean, what's the psychology behind that?
Well, that's a very important question, Summer, and that really gets to the heart of the matter because, you know, we hear these gentlemen speaking about Christianity being responsible for all these, allegedly responsible for all these terrorist attacks, whereas Islam has no responsibility for the terror attacks. There's a tremendous amount of bad faith in what they're saying because, in the first place, you're talking about maybe half a dozen murders of abortion clinic doctors, and no Christian church accepting that or saying that that's a good thing, whereas you have thousands, actually over 16,000 terror attacks carried out in the name of Islam since 9/11 alone, and those all have had the approval of Islamic clerics in various places. I'm very glad to hear that there are other Islamic clerics who say that they're a bad idea and should not have been done. But there's very broad approval, particularly in places like Pakistan and Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, very immense approval for the ideology represented by Osama bin Laden and other jihad terrorists. And so you speak about Muslims who oppose these things. In the first place, yes, of course there's an intimidation factor. They would be victimized just as much as non-Muslims if they stuck their neck out. But also, the fact is that nobody, contrary to these claims by these gentlemen, Mr. Kundi, is it, and Mr. Zayed, contrary to their claims that Muslims are being demonized, actually they're the ones doing the demonizing, immediately beginning the ad hominem attacks against Dr. Pipes and me, and immediately impugning our motives when we said nothing about either of them. And they are the ones who are sidestepping the real question, which is, what is it in the teachings of Islam that the Islamic Jihad terrorists are able to exploit and can and do exploit in order to justify their actions among peaceful Muslims and make recruits among them? And the fact is that peaceful Muslims generally do not speak out because not only are they intimidated by the threat of violence, but also because the Islamic jihadists generally around the world present themselves as being the exponents of pure, authentic, and true Islam, the ones who are carrying out the teachings of the Quran and the Sunnah most faithfully. And as a result of that, the so-called moderates or peaceful Muslims don't actually find generally that they have a theological or jurisprudential leg to stand on within Islam. And so they don't speak up because they don't want to be branded as renegades or heretics or unfaithful Muslims who are not being true to the teachings that the jihad terrorists are exploiting. It's noteworthy that we have seen international riots about cartoons. We have seen international riots about a statement that made by the Pope in passing. We have seen international riots about various other things, but we've never seen any kind of protests or any kind of anger in the Islamic world against these people who are supposedly criminals who are twisting the peaceful and true teachings of Islam. Nobody seems to get upset about them all over the Islamic world, and yet they continue in large numbers to commit terror attacks and to justify them in the name of Islam. There's absolutely no comparison that can be made to a handful of abortion clinic bombers who've been condemned by every Christian group on the planet.
Okay, and with that, we have to take a quick break. When we return, we'll continue on tonight's topic. Has Islam been hijacked by radicals? We'll also start to take your calls. Our line is 248-416-1300. Call us live on Jihad Exposed here on ABN. We'll be right back.
The United States is not and will never be at war with Islam. In fact, our partnership with the Muslim world is critical, not just in rolling back the violent ideologies that people of all faiths reject, but also to strengthen opportunity for all people. I also want to be clear that America's relationship with the Muslim community, the Muslim world, cannot and will not just be based upon opposition to terrorism. We seek broader engagement based on mutual interest and mutual respect. We will listen carefully, we will bridge misunderstandings, and we will seek common ground. We will be respectful even when we do not agree. We will convey our deep appreciation for the Islamic faith, which has done so much over the centuries to shape the world, including in my own country. The United States has been enriched by Muslim Americans. Many other Americans have Muslims in their families or have lived in a Muslim-majority country. I know because I am one of them.
Jihad has come to America.
Constitutes the most devastating series of terrorist attacks in history.
The only deen Allah accepts is Al-Islam. And whoever sees any other deen apart from Islam will never be accepted.
Allahu Akbar! we stand together to win the war against terrorism.
Welcome back to Jihad Exposed. Tonight's topic, has Islam been hijacked by radicals, where we take a look at what the true form of Islam is. Before I turn it back over to Dr. Pipes, Mustafa, if you can sort of answer, Islam is supposed to be a religion of peace, love, coexistence with other religions. If that is true, why do we see Muslims as the primary persecutors of Christian worldwide? A lot of our audience would like to know.
Well, that is not true, and I'll give you an example. And actually, Thomas Walker Arnold, one of the greatest Orientalists, had made that observation, not me. He said, well, the Eastern churches were separated from Rome, so they were considered heretics of the religion. They had no support from the rest of the Christendom. Now, after 1,400 years of Islam, and all these Muslims and Islamic states throughout the Middle East and the Muslim world, how come there are millions upon millions of Christians that live in Muslim countries who supported them throughout that time and who supported their churches? Give you that as a comparison, because you say the Muslims are the main persecutors of Christians. Did the Muslims do to the local Christians what, for example, Ferdinand and Isabel did to the Muslims and the Jews in Spain? Never. Convert or we kill you. Even a rabbi friend told me, even if you got baptized, you'll be killed. Did they do to them what, let's say, the Serbs did to the Bosnian Muslims? That never happened. Islam respects only two religions, that's Judaism and Christianity. And Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and let me now bring a quote from the Prophet that Mr. Spencer claims, that we need to look at the teachings of the Quran and the hadith of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Whoever would hurt a non-Muslim in a Muslim state unjustly, I am his opponent on Judgment Day. Find me a prophet that says that. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, received the Christians of Najran and let him perform their rituals inside the mosque of the Prophet himself. Said that your rights are our rights and your obligations are my obligations. And if your churches will start to fall apart, I will remodel it from the treasury of the Muslims. Throughout history, and let me remind you again, the only non-Christian faith that believes in the Immaculate Birth of Jesus, peace be upon him, and Virgin Mary are the Muslims, no one else.
Okay, but can you wind it out? Help us understand, when you say Islam respects Judaism and Christianity, what do you mean by respect? Can you help us understand? Because if it were a Sharia-driven society, I believe Christians, or any non-Muslim, would be subjugated to Islamic law. Is that true?
That's one of the lies and fabrications, unfortunately, that you two gentlemen out there perpetrate without any proof whatsoever. A, number one, Islam acknowledges only two other religions as religions, that they can build their places of worship and practice the religion freely. That's Christianity and Judaism, because they are phases in Islam. 25 prophets in the Quran. You cannot become a Muslim unless you believe in all of them. 16 of them are Jewish prophets. Jesus, peace be upon him, is a major, mighty prophet of Islam. If you don't believe in him, you're not a Muslim. To start, Sharia law is the law that protected Jews and Christians. For example, you look at the Inquisitions. Where did the Jews escape to when it happened? Convert or we kill you. To the nearest Muslim country. For 350 years in England, you cannot exist if you're a Jewish person. You cannot even enter there. They were not only existing in Muslim countries in Andalusia and Spain and Portugal, they thrived and prospered with Christians and Muslims under Islamic law. Islamic law is what protected the freedom of religion of Christians and Jews. Final example.
Okay.
Umar ibn al-Khattab, one of the greatest caliphs and rulers of Islam, came to pray in one of the major churches of Jerusalem. And time of prayers came in. He refused to pray inside and went to pray outside because he didn't want anyone to say, well, I seen the ruler of Islam praying there. It must be a mosque and take it over to respect the rights of Christians. Show me any place in the world that ever happened.
Here's okay. Islam. All right. Let's turn it over to Robert. Part of his claim was that Christians or any non-Muslim would not be subjugated under Islamic law. Go ahead whenever you're ready.
Well, That's just manifestly false. Christians and Jews never enjoyed equality of rights with Muslims in any Islamic society, except when Islamic laws were being relaxed. And when they were relaxed, then there was a backlash against their relaxation from Muslims who were angry about their being relaxed. The most notable example is in 1066 in Granada, in supposedly tolerant and multiculturalist Muslim Spain, when a Jew was put in charge of a local area. The Muslims rioted and committed a pogrom, killing 4,000 Jews in that area because they understood that in Islamic law it was forbidden for a non-Muslim to hold authority over a Muslim. As far as his other examples go, we can argue about history all night, but your question actually, Mr. Zayed, entirely sidestepped. Your question was, why are Christians being persecuted in Muslim lands? I understood, now you correct me if I'm wrong, but Summer, I understood your question to be about Christians in Muslim lands today. For example, the Christians who were massacred by Islamic jihadists in church in Baghdad, 58 Christians murdered there just a few weeks ago. The Christians being persecuted on a large scale in Egypt, in Pakistan, in Indonesia, in Nigeria, and all in the name of Islam and in accordance with the teachings of Islamic law. All that Mr. Zayed can do in the face of that is ignore it and talk about history and misrepresent history in rosy terms as if Christians and Jews had it better in Islamic lands than Jews had it in Europe. This is a widespread historical myth, but the numbers tell the tale. There were about 16 or 17 million Jews in the world at the beginning of the 20th century, and all but 1 million of them lived in Europe. And so if the Islamic world were really so much better for Jews than Christian Europe was at that time, then it's very remarkable that Jews didn't vote with their feet and all moved to the Muslim world at a time when it was so bad for them in Christian Europe. Actually, they did just the opposite because they knew where conditions were better. Now, the reality of the situation is the same now. We're not really here to talk about history. We're here to talk about the reality of Islam today. And unfortunately, it is still part of Islamic law that Jews and Christians must be subjugated under its rule, be denied basic rights, and live as inferiors in the Islamic State. It is in the service of trying to enforce those laws that Christians are being persecuted in Muslim lands today. There is nothing comparable happening to Muslims in the West, where actually they enjoy exactly the same rights and privileges, and sometimes more than those of the than do the general population. And so, it's very nice to go and have some history lessons, but it really doesn't ameliorate the pain that Christians in Iraq and Christians in Egypt and Christians in Pakistan and Indonesia and elsewhere in the Islamic world today are facing from Muslims, inflicted by Muslims, who are enforcing Islamic law.
Okay, is there any risk, Dr. Pipes, or any danger involved with having the position, taking the position that Islam has in fact been hijacked?
I think it's a nonsensical position. This is a legitimate version of Islam. It is obvious it's legitimate because someone like Osama bin Laden is very popular. There have been no end of children named after him, stamps, pictures of his for sale. This is not some renegade. This is someone who is popular. But more basically, I came on this program on the condition that there not be ad hominem attacks. For some reason, one of the imams, I think Mr. Zayed, said that I was lying. If I'm going to continue on, I need to make clear that I don't want to be attacked in this way. I don't know what my supposed lies are, but this is not the kind of discussion that I want to have. So let's make it clear. No ad hominem attacks. We discuss the issue. This is a typical example of Islamist attack, and I, for one, am not going to stand for this. But I'll stay on, but I'm not going to stand for another one.
Right, thank you.
On the question of Christians in Muslim countries, Christians have rights, as do Jews and Sabaeans, under Islamic law, but they're clearly and always inferior under Islamic law to Muslims. It is a precept, a fundamental precept of the Islamic religion that Muslims are superior to non-Muslims. This is fundamental to Islamic law. Now, when you look at the situation today, as Mr. Spencer pointed out, in countries like Iraq and Egypt and Lebanon and Pakistan, there is an attack on Christians, which is causing them to leave. You have a flight of Christians out of the Muslim-majority countries that's very marked, and if it should continue as it is now underway, there will essentially be vestigial Christian populations, as there are now vestigial Jewish populations. 1 million Jews in the Middle East 50 years ago, 60 years ago, has withered down to 50,000 or so. It is certainly possible that the same kind of reduction in numbers for Christians in the years to come. I am a historian. I'm not a specialist on religion, but on history. And I look at what actually takes place, and I see that throughout history, the main political force of Islam has been to establish the superiority of Muslims over non-Muslims and pious Muslims over non-pious Muslims. This is the driving force of Islam. I believe that this can change. I believe that Islam can modernize. I believe that Islam can become moderate and modern. Some analysts may know it can't. I believe it can. I am hopeful. I am hopeful that voices in the Muslim world today are now developing different understandings of what jihad is, what it means to be a Muslim. I think that Islam can be integrated, can become a moderate religion. But historically, no. Historically, Islam has not been moderate. Historically, Islam has been imperialist and supremacist.
Can you maybe expand on that a little, on if Islam can be moderate? Are you talking about reform? You're talking about, can you help us understand a little more? Because there's Muslims that disagree with other Muslims in their own community on interpretation of the Quran, for example. So how can we expect coexistence between Muslims and non-Muslims in this way?
Indeed, there are many differences among Muslims about what it means to be a Muslim, how to understand the Quran and other sacred scriptures. Islam changes and develops, as do other religions. As I mentioned before, I've seen in my own career of 4-plus decades great changes in Islam. And if it can change for the worse, which has happened over these 4 decades, it can change for the better. I think our policies, our efforts should be to help Muslims find, discover, invent, develop a modern form of Islam, not a supremacist form, not a medieval form, but a modern form which can live in two things in particular, where Muslims and non-Muslims can live in harmony, and men and women can. I mean, if Islam stands for two things historically, it's Muslims dominating non-Muslims and males dominating females. This has got to go. This is not going to work in the modern age. This is completely antithetical, in particular, to how we live as Americans.
Let's turn it over to Abdullah, and then we'll take our first call. Abdullah, as a Muslim, do you believe that, do you agree with Dr. Pipes that a moderate version of Islam can exist in the future?
Well, I would say that a moderate version exists now and has existed from the very beginning, and that is called Islam, that is called traditional Islam. I think that, just to kind of touch on a couple of points, I'd first of all like to apologize to Daniel. I think that perhaps what I said was interpreted as a ad hominem attack. It certainly wasn't meant to be directed personally, and Robert made a similar comment, and I apologize to you also, Robert. The point there that I was trying to make was to identify a group which is utilized by the media. Having said that, I think that in order to genuinely engage with some of the comments that have been made, we need to be presented with objective evidence for a couple of the statements that have been made by both Robert and Daniel, and also we need points of clarification. Now, Robert and Daniel have both said that there are aspects of Islamic law which make non-Muslim citizens of a Muslim state lesser. Well, can they give one example that applies to either Christians or Jews or both so that I actually have something to engage with? Secondly, Daniel suggested that Osama bin Laden is very popular and that many children have been named after him. Well, again, I'd need some sort of objective evidence for that. Otherwise, that's just a statement. Now, Robert also asked a question earlier about where are all the Muslims that are renouncing terrorism? Well, they're everywhere and they're very public. And indeed, in the United States, I mean, one very prominent Muslim immediately comes to mind, Sheikh Hamza Yusuf Hansen, who is popular not only in the Western world, but also in the Islamic world, but, you know, considered to be authoritative by basically all Muslims. and who not only publicly renounced the September 11 attacks, not only has consistently publicly renounced the consistent violence in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan, but he was actually even utilized by former President George W. Bush as an advisor on Islamic issues. So, and this is somebody that's respected worldwide and has millions of followers. I wonder how many more significant personalities there need to be. Now, Robert has then also gone to say that there's many scholars in Saudi Arabia that support the terrorist attacks. Well, again, I need an objective bit of evidence. At least one name would be something that I could engage with. Now, I've given one name of a very prominent scholar who is respected worldwide by all Muslims, who publicly denounces these attacks, and who also was utilized by the American president as an advisor on Islam. Could Robert give a comparable example for these terrorist-supporting Muslims that he suggests? So I guess in answer to the question overall and engaging with those points, I'd say that traditional Islam is what I guess Daniel and Robert refer to as moderate Islam. It's existed from the very beginning. It exists today. And the majority of scholars and the majority of Muslims support it. I'd say that the only reason why we're not discussing it now is because it's not very interesting generally in the media.
Okay, let's turn it over to Robert if you would like an opportunity to respond. But also, I guess I'm more concerned with not necessarily the positions on some leading Islamic scholars here in the West, because that might even just be subject to their interpretation of Islam. But more I'm concerned with, like Abdullah, you give the example of 9/11. I'm more concerned with Islam and its relation to 9/11, not a Muslim scholar's interpretation or justification or public publicly condemning 9/11. Robert, did you have a response?
Oh, very much so. There's a certain amount of bait and switch going on here. I wasn't talking about terrorism. I don't have memorized everything I've said, but I don't think I even mentioned it, except in regard to the terrorist attacks, the 16,000 terrorist attacks. I was speaking about the fact that the sects and schools of Islam variously all agree in teaching warfare against unbelievers and the necessity to subjugate those unbelievers under the rule of Islamic law. That really is something that can be done with terrorism or can be done in any variety of other ways. And so if a Muslim says that he rejects terrorism, I think that's great, but there are several questions that come to mind. First thing, I want to know what he means by terrorism. For example, the Deobandi school in India, a very prominent school of Islam in India and the surrounding areas, recently, I believe it was a year or so ago, condemned terrorism. And it was international headlines and hosannas and all sorts of people getting all excited about it until you started to read the documents, which made it clear that they were condemning the terrorism that they alleged was being committed by the United States and Israel and never mentioned anything done by Muslims in connection with terrorism at all. The same thing with the idea of Islam or Islamic scholars condemning attacks on innocent civilians. That's great, but then you have Islamic clerics in Britain and elsewhere saying there are no innocent non-Muslims because non-Muslims are in a state of rebellion against the true prophet, the Prophet Muhammad of Islam, and against the true religion. And as such, there are no innocents among them. And so if you condemn attacks on innocent civilians, you're essentially saying nothing that would rebuke the jihad terrorists in the world today. The problem is much larger than that of terrorism. And then the challenge is to give an example. Sure, I can give you lots of examples of scholars who teach these kinds of things. Muhammad Salah al-Munajjid out of Saudi Arabia, the scholar behind Islam Q&A online, Abu Bakar Bashir in Indonesia, many, many others who teach that it is part of the responsibility of Muslims to wage war against unbelievers. But I don't want to give the impression by giving you a couple of names, and I could give you many other names, that these things were invented by these people. They present present themselves, just as Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, did, Sayyid Qutb, the great scholar of the Muslim Brotherhood, Maulana Maududi in Pakistan, and others, great figures of the 20th century, they presented themselves as representing the true teachings of Islam. Qutb and Maududi wrote commentaries, extensive multi-volume commentaries on the Quran, which forthrightly taught, based on what they understood the Quran to be saying, and based also on Islamic tradition and the mainstream ways in which the Quran had always been interpreted, they taught that it was part of the responsibility of the Muslim community worldwide to wage war against unbelievers in order to subjugate them under the rule of Islamic law. Not necessarily a hot war. If they could do it by stealth, if they could do it by deception, if they could do it by step-by-step ways to impose Islamic law, the way these things are going on in the West, while Islamic scholars like these two gentlemen with us tonight issue a lot of deceptions and diversions and finger-pointing about Christianity and so on, so as to confuse and befuddle people and take their attention away from how Islamic law is advancing in the West, then that would be just fine and just as good as a terrorist bombing, which does the job in another way. But the objective is the same, and that is, as Dr. Pipes was explaining, to put Muslims in a superior position in society, non-Muslims in a subservient position in society, along with women. These things are part and parcel of the mainstream teachings of Islam, always have been. And these gentlemen, you notice, they don't deny it, they just divert. They just start changing the subject and talking about something else. And so this is part of the program that I would expect they themselves also are trying to impose. But even if they aren't, they are directing their venom against us as per their ad hominem attacks earlier. And I note the apology and thank you for it. But nonetheless, the strategy in a larger sense, not just from these gentlemen, but from many other Islamic spokesmen, is to demonize the people who are non-Muslims, who are calling attention to these aspects of Islam, to these teachings of Islam, and to try to fabricate the idea that it is we who are making these things up and propagating these things, and to ignore entirely the Muslims who are teaching these things in Islamic communities and stirring up Muslims worldwide to wage war in various ways against unbelievers, which is manifestly what is happening.
Do you have a verse that can justify Islam calling for the subjugation of non-Muslims?
The most notorious one is chapter 9, verse 29, Surah At-Tawbah, chapter 9 of the Quran, which in verse 29 says that Muslims should wage war against those who do not believe in Allah and His Messenger and do not forbid what He has forbidden, even if they are of the people of the book, which is primarily Jews and Christians, until they pay the jizya, the tax, with willing submission and feel themselves subdued. And that last clause about submitting and feeling themselves subdued became the cornerstone in Islamic law throughout history of an elaborate superstructure of laws that mandated that non-Muslims would indeed feel themselves subdued and be subjugated in Islamic societies, denied basic rights. These things, unfortunately, are still part of Islamic law. They can't really be changed easily. You know, I certainly would hope that there could arise new interpretations that would be generally accepted, come to be widely accepted in the Islamic world, but right now they run up against the hard facts of what is actually in the Quran and the way these things have always been interpreted. Surah At-Tawbah, the Surah of Repentance, the ninth chapter of the Quran is generally considered to take precedence, considered by Islamic scholars, that is, mainstream Islamic scholars, to take precedence over other parts of the Quran that are generally more peaceful and teach something more akin to tolerance. And as long as that remains a mainstream view among Islamic scholars, then Muslims are going in the sense of out of a sense of piety, out of a sense of a religious responsibility, going to work to try to subjugate non-Muslims under the rule of Islamic law. And all we have to do is open our eyes and see that happening worldwide. That's not happening because of me. That's not happening because of Dr. Pipes. That's happening because of what the Quran teaches.
Okay, let's take our first call and then we'll bring it back to Imam. Most of a quick announcement before we take our first call. Next week, Jihad Exposed, our topic will be, is Al-Qaeda justified in Islam? Our four guests next week who will join us, if you remember, Omar Bakri Muhammad, as well as Anjum Chowdhury, Waleed Shabbat, and Kamal Saleem. So stay tuned for that. Right now, let's take our first call this evening. You're live on Jihad Exposed. Who do we have on air with us?
Hello, Summer. This is Peter calling from Germany.
Welcome, Peter. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome. It's a very interesting show. I would like to make a couple of comments, if I may.
Yes, go right ahead.
Okay. In the beginning, the two Muslim gentlemen said mentioned what happened by Christians, what Christians done in Bosnia, for example. But they forgot to mention that Christians also helped the Muslims there and to end this bloodshed. This is the first question, the first comment I wanted to make. And the other thing is, have you ever recognized that whatever Christian nations did in the past, there was a confession? We're still waiting for the confession of Turkey for the Armenian genocide. There's no confession from the Muslim side whatsoever. And that's why people start waking up and not believing that Islam is peace and Islam is moderate. If there's no confession about it, there will be no peace. I'm calling from Germany. We have a confession what happened 65 years ago to the Jewish people. Well, guess what? We have peace with them now. Germany is prosperous. You know, that's what I wanted to say, just that, and maybe the gentleman can elaborate on that.
Yes.
And I wanted to thank you. I thank also ABN, Robert Spencer, and Mr. Pipes for their hard work, and you are not alone. We are behind you.
Thank you so much for calling, Peter from Germany. Let's turn it over to Dr. Pipes, who could probably elaborate a little on that for you.
So I defer.
Dr. Pipes, are you with us?
I'm with you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
I was saying he wasn't asking the questions of me.
Oh, yeah.
He was supporting me, so I defer.
Oh, okay. Welcome back to Jihad Exposed, live on ABN. Before we take our next call, I'd like to just ask Imam Mustafa a few questions here. We see Saudi spending, Imam Mustafa, almost $3 billion trying to export their radical version of Islam globally. If that's the case, that's a lot of money. If that's the case, why? I mean, you're saying that it has nothing to do with Islam. Where are they getting this ideology from? Why are they so intent on spreading such a radical ideology globally if it has nothing to do with the religion of Islam?
Well, the question itself is pregnant with a supposition that the Muslim charity to Muslim worlds out there is funding terrorism or radical whatever. That is not true. You do not know that. There's no objective evidence of that. Most importantly, the thing that kept repeating by Mr. Spencer and Mr. Pipes, different versions of Islam, radical Islam, moderate Islam, terrorist Islam, Islam with gravy or whatever, there's nothing that supports that. And when we brought examples of the behavior of the Prophet of Islam himself, Mr. Spencer said that, you know what, you're bringing me back to history. You want me to bring you examples of Prophet Muhammad that are yet to come or tell you what the Prophet of Islam himself said about the topics that you're talking about? Again, Mr. Pipes misunderstood me. What I meant is that Mr. Pipes, being a PhD in history, when you make a claim such as that Islam is a supremacist religion or is an imperialistic religion, bring me a proof from the Quran or the correct hadith of the Prophet. For example, the verse that Mr. Spencer brought that he proves the subjugation of non-Muslims in Muslims land. What it means is that people who evade paying taxes should be forced to pay taxes. And that is applicable to Muslims before it's applicable to non-Muslims. Abu Bakr fought the Muslims who refused to pay the poor right and the riches money in what is known by Harb al-Ridda. So you don't tell me that a non-Muslim who's living in a Muslim state afforded the peace and security in a Muslim state and he should live tax-free, otherwise he's persecuted. And these are the quality of the examples that, and we heard it so many times from Mr. Spencer, oh, it's all over Sharia, it's all over Quran, it's all over Hadith. And as usual, I authored The Lies About Muhammad, 400 pages, and I answered the ideology of Mr. Spencer page by page and paragraph by paragraph, and it speaks for itself. I'll give you another example before I move
Before you go on to the next example, let me just ask you a quick question on this example so we stay on topic. So you're saying basically under an Islamic state, nowhere in the Quran it states that a non-Muslim is subjugated to Islamic law, whether it be pay the jizya tax or convert to Islam or be killed. That's not listed in the Quran.
Muslims pay tax, non-Muslim pay tax. For example, that Muslim tax, the jizya tax, is 1 dinar per year, which is equivalent to $100 per
but
year.
I'm asking you just a straightforward question. Basically, if a non-Muslim, I'm not a Muslim, if the United States became an Islamic state, would I be subjugated to either become Muslim or pay the jizya tax or be killed?
If you choose to be a Muslim, you pay the Muslim tax. If you are a non-Muslim, you pay the non-Muslim tax. And it's a fair tax. An example, $100 per year per person. The rabbi, the priest, the children, the women do not pay, only be able to fight men.
What if I don't want to pay the tax or become a Muslim? What happens?
What if you want to pay tax in America, which is not a Muslim state now? What would they do to you?
Well, I wouldn't be killed. I don't think I'd be killed. Right?
Well, who said that you're going to be killed
if
you don't pay tax?
Right, well, that's just my question. I just wanted to ask the question because it's been said that the Quran does state that you have those three options as a non-Muslim in an Islamic state, which is what I wanted clarification on.
The verse is there. If you don't pay tax, you should be fought by the authorities like the IRS, fight people in this country if they evade or cheat on taxes, like any country in the world. It's not unique to the Muslims, and the Muslims themselves pay tax, and if they don't pay, they would be subject to the authorities for paying their taxes. On top of that, here's the subjugating aspect of also being a non-Muslim. You're exempt from military service. How bad is that? I bet Mr. Spencer would want every Christian to go there and be killed, him and his children, just not to be persecuted by Muslims for not being exempt from the military service. That's the kind of nonsense that we hear. So I ask of Mr. Spencer, and I ask for Mr. Pipes, when you make these broad claims, that is in the Quran and the Hadith, show me one Hadith, show me a verse in the Quran, show me the verse before and the verse after, and say that to your readers, and let them decide for themselves.
Okay, Robert, real quick, and then we'll take our next call.
Well, here again, you have this desire of being dishonest and doing this bait and switch. I was speaking about his examples about Ferdinand and Isabella and so on. He pretends that I was referring to his examples about Muhammad when I said we're talking about now he's just giving history instead of present examples. What he quoted about Muhammad was that Muhammad said, don't kill the Christians and Jews in the Islamic State. That's right, because they had to stay alive to pay taxes that would support the Islamic State. But that doesn't mean they had equality of rights. You notice he sidestepped your question entirely about whether Jews and Christians would enjoy equality of rights in the Islamic State. They don't. And the idea that the taxes that Muslims pay and that non-Muslims pay in the Islamic State are equivalent is false on the face of it, because all you have to do is look at the populations of the non-Muslims in the Islamic states and see how they steadily went down over history because they had to pay these draconian, the non-Muslims had to pay these huge tax rates. All they had to do to get out from under the crushing burdens that they had in these taxes was to convert to Islam. And so this is what happened to those populations. And nowadays, we have the same thing, that the problem with the rosy picture of Islam that Mr. Zayed is painting and the idea that he's trying to claim that I am somehow misrepresenting Islam is that Muslims all around the world are misunderstanding Islam the same way that I am. And Muslims all around the world are misapplying Islam and thinking that it has to do with warfare against Jews and Christians and subjugating Jews and Christians under the rule of Islamic law in exactly the same way that I am. And I don't know how they all got it so wrong and somehow misunderstood all these plain teachings that only I and my wickedness am misrepresenting. Really, Mr. Zayed's position is so palpably ridiculous, as is his book that purports to refute mine. My book, The Truth About Muhammad, is based on the earliest Islamic texts about Muhammad, the prophet of Islam. And all that Mr. Zayed offers in his 400 pages of alleged refutation is the same kind of thing he's offering here. Diversion, deception, accusations, and finger-pointing, but no substance whatsoever.
Okay, thank you for that. We have to take our next call. You're live on Jihad Exposed. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello, you're live. Who do we have on air?
Yes, my name is Rashid. I'm a former Muslim. I can't say where I'm calling from just because of security reasons, but I was watching your show. I'm really surprised that the Imam Mustafa is quoting Hadith, says, whoever hurts a dhimmi, I'm his adversary.
Are you still with us? Oh, we must have lost that call. We apologize for that. Please call us back, Rashid. Let's take our next call. You're live on ABN.
Hi. Good evening.
Good evening. Welcome.
Yeah, I just want to, I'm a Muslim myself. I'd like to, you know, advise you when you contact a meeting like this, you should have a, like a clock in front of you. Give a chance to the both of them. It seems you're taking a side. That's obvious, but be, you got to be honest. Give a time for both sides. Look, the gentleman, is
we're
he talking get,
sir,
about...
Sir, we're giving equal time for the people. We have a clock right there. Do you have a specific question for our panelists?
For you. Verse 929.
Yes.
That's a gentleman who is talking about, it says, قَاتُلُوا الَّذِينَ لَا يَدِينُ دِينِ الْحَقِّ. It says, fight with those who don't practice. They talk about the atheists in Mecca. This verses had a division. One for those atheists worshipping idols, and the second addressing the people of the book, which is a Christian and Jew, to pay tax. And if we see, we have to make some statements like, you see, the Prophet, be peace upon him, one of his wife was a Christian. Another one was a Jewish. You see, in Islam, allowed us to eat your food, allowed us to marry your women. And they said, God Almighty telling us in the Quran, that's the closest near to us or those who claim they are followers of Jesus. Let's have some bliss, some bridges, understanding each other. We okay. condemn terrorism, we condemn killing innocent people. Let's have some dialogue and some bridging. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for calling. I don't think Dr. Pipes or Robert were condemning Muslims. We're just trying to get to the bottom of what Islam teaches, from my understanding. They're not saying that Muslims support terrorism. I think even Robert said that, you know, there are Muslims out there that do publicly condemn terrorism. But again, it's Islam and it's not Muslims that we're trying to get to the bottom of. Let's take our next call here on Jihad Exposed.
Hello.
Hi, welcome.
It's me again, Rashid. As Rashid. I said, I'm a former Muslim, and I can say where I'm calling from. And I heard Imam Mustafa saying that, quoting a hadith, saying, whoever hurts a dhimmi, I'm his adversary, and I shall be an adversary to him on the day of resurrection. And he knows that's a hadith da'if. That's a weak hadith. It's not an authentic hadith. And he tried to ignore another hadith, which is in Sahih Muslim. It says, Muhammad is saying, لَأُخْرِجَنَّ الْيَهُودُ وَالنَّصَارَ مِنْ جَزِيرَةِ الْعَرَبِ حَتَّى لَأَدَعَ إِلَّا مُسْلِمًا. Muhammad was saying that I will kick out Jews and Christians from the Arabic Peninsula, and I will not let only Muslims will be there. And he forgot to quote another hadith Sahih saying, لَتَبْدَأُ الْيَهُودَ وَالنَّصَارَ بِالسَّلَامِ بَعْضُ لا تبدأوا اليهود والنصارى بالسلام وإذا وجدتم أحدهم في طريق فاضطروا إلى أضيافه. Don't start Christians and Jews with saying salam to them. And if you find whoever you find them in the street, you can push them to the narrow side. I'm trying to translate from the Arabic hadith. And he just using a weak hadith among other authentic hadiths and trying to ignore even their existence. He said also that Islam respects Christians and Jews, and that's really a joke because my father is an imam until now, and he raised me as to hate Jews and Christians. And he said they are kuffars, they are infidels, and we should wage war against them. And he used as an argument why we still have millions of Christians in the Middle East. And I will say to him, because they paid jizya, because they paid money to Muslims, how about the millions who were killed under the rule of Islam? How about millions killed in Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia? The North African church, whom the fathers were Tertullian and Augustine and others, they were erased from the map. And you go back, Mr. Mustafa, to Muqaddimat ibn Khaldun, and you can read about how Muslims killed Jews and Christians in those countries. So my argument here, Islam hates Jews and Christians. If we go to the biography of Muhammad, we will find that he killed the Jews, he killed Bani Qurayda, he killed the Christians, he kicked them out from the Arabic Peninsula, and he wanted them either to be Muslims or to be killed. They had no other options. And in other places, they pay jizya. He said jizya just a tax. No, sir. It's a war tax. You don't pay tax in America or in Europe and you feel subdued. You don't do that. It's a war tax. You pay a higher tax to the Muslims because you refuse their religion. It's just a way to stay in your religion.
Sorry to cut you off. We have to go on to our next call. I apologize for cutting you off. We're running a little short on time, and our phone lines are very busy. Abdullah, did you have any comments before we took the next call?
I thank the call for his call, and thank Daniel and Robert for the discussion thus far. I think that it's important to recognise that Robert, when I asked him to give an example of a specific law where non-Muslims are subjugated in an Islamic nation under Islamic law, he only quoted the jizya, which, as Mustafa correctly outlined, is just a tax. Muslims have the same tax. It's to a greater extent monetary terms, and likewise, Muslims don't get the benefit out of it of being protected. Now, this tax has to be returned if the Muslims can't protect the non-Muslims that are paying it. Now, to answer your question, Summer, you asked, well, if I live in America, America becomes an Islamic state, and I don't want to become Muslim, I don't want to pay the tax, do I get killed? No, you don't. You'll be free to leave. And in fact, this has been practiced in multiple times throughout Islamic history. The prime example would be Salah ad-Din. Robert also, he's saying he doesn't want to appeal to history, but he does appeal to history in some of his evidences. And one of the challenges that he put forward was that every time Muslims have given this relaxed interpretation, as he says, of the law, i.e., for example, allowing non-Muslims to leave an Islamic land once conquered, they were then rejected. Well, was Salah ad-Din challenged? Was he rejected? Who was the chief physician to Salah ad-Din? It was Moses Maimonides, or as the Jews would know him, Rambam. Nobody rejected Salah ad-Din doing this. Nobody challenged him. Nobody challenged him when he let the Christians leave peacefully and not be attacked. So in reality, we've got this argument which is basically non-existent. I asked for one example. We weren't given an example. In fact, I could give examples to the contrary of where non-Muslim nations do not present the equality, inverted commas, that Robert speaks about. Now, in the country that most of you are in at the moment, the United States, homosexual people are not allowed to get married. Is that equality? Is it equality that heterosexual people can get married and homosexual people can't? Now, in simple terms, it's normal for society to have slightly different rules for different interest groups. And to say that Muslims are unfair or unjust or unequal in their dealings with non-Muslims is just ridiculous.
Okay, Dr. Pipes, any response you have for Abdullah?
Yes, indeed. I was asked about supplying a surah of the Quran that shows that it's supremacist. But I think I've made it clear that I'm not a Quran specialist. I'm a historian. And my point was not to analyze the Quran, but to look at 1,400 years of history and to say that over 1,400 years, the driving force of Islam has almost everywhere at all times been to assert the superiority of Muslim over non-Muslim. I don't need a verse in the Quran. There are plenty of verses, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about history. I am a historian. I'm talking about history. This is the basic history of Islam, to assert superiority over non-Muslims. Now, let's talk about what happens when non-Muslims are ruled by Muslims. We've been talking about the jizya tax. And what I found fascinating is that Imam Mustafa acknowledges that were Islamic law to be applied in the United States, you, Summer, would be paying an additional tax. This is an extraordinary concession. In other words, you as a non-Muslim would have an onus that Muslims don't have. This is what stands in front of us should we have Islamic law. Imam Abdullah asked for other examples besides the jizya law, the jizya tax, which is not $100, which is a very, very substantial tax historically. There are many other sumptuary laws, humiliation. The entire life of the dhimmi, of the Christian, Jew, or Saban living under Muslim law is one of humiliation, powerlessness, of being reminded on a daily, indeed an hourly basis, that you are an inferior and that you should convert and that you are someone living at the tolerance of Islamic law, but you're inferior.
And one symbol of this, one interesting one, is that Muslim men are allowed to marry non-Muslim women, but not the reverse. There's a kind of, again, this brings together the two things, Muslim over non-Muslim and male over female. It's a profoundly unequal system of living. Islam is profoundly unequal, comes out of a tribal background, is profoundly unequal. In the 12th century or the 15th century, all the other parts of the world were also unequal. But today, when we have achieved an equality, a liberalism, a democracy, a personal freedom, Islam or Islamic law is out of date, is retrograde. It's something that you and I would despair of going back to, because we've left that. We've left these inequalities. We now have equality. And the idea that we should revert to a Shari system whereby Muslims have superiority over non-Muslims and males have superiority over females is profoundly unacceptable. And Islam needs to change. It needs to become modern. And what these two gentlemen are representing is the most retrograde kind of Islam that wants to pull us back into the medieval period, that's indeed engaged in religious attacks. No, that's not. I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about history and politics and the way we live. And I'm fine with Islam, but it's got to be an Islam that's modern and that fits in, particularly as we're all four of us on this panel living in the West, has to fit into Western ways of living. We've achieved something in the West. We don't want to give it up in order to go back to the Sharia.
Mm-hmm. And with that, we will take our next call. You're live on ABN.
Hello?
Yes, you're live. What's your question and who's it for?
Hi, good evening, ma'am. My name is Rich, for short. Sorry, my name is Richard for short, calling from New Jersey. Big Tech, my friend. And I had a question for the panel here. Tommy, hello, assalamu alaikum, shalom. That comes to all. My question for each of you is that what real world exposure do you have to the opposite side? To the Muslim men, do you have any Christian friends that you attend celebrations or churches? To the Christian men, do you have any Muslim friends who attend their festivals? Let me simplify that. I'm in the service and I work with Muslim people, Muslim soldiers, and we attend each other's functions. I've been deployed with them, no problems at all. And even when I was in Iraq, I saw Christians and Arab Christians, and Arab Muslims getting along peacefully. So it was kind of like a new term for me. Thank you for your answers. God, Allah, Yahweh, bless you, and have a happy holiday.
Okay, I think two things. One, I'd like Imam Mustafa to respond, but I think that the key behind his question was possibly something like, why can't Muslims and Christians possibly coexist peacefully? Imam Mustafa, did you want to address that?
Of course they coexist peacefully. I grew up with Christian friends in Egypt. Tomorrow I'm visiting one of my Christian friends and his family with my father, who's his best friend, is that Christian man who I call uncle. I want to make clear that to validate the peaceful aspect of Islam that is mandated by the Quran and the Prophet of Islam, I don't have to prove that by having to have Christian friends and Jewish friends. I can be peaceful and I might not come along with them in certain ways or just not happen to have interaction with them on a business aspect or not. Having said that, I speak in churches oftenly. I have some of my best friends who are priests, pastors. Some of my good friends are Jewish. I was in the financial markets before and some of my best friends were Jewish. I live in New Jersey like the gentleman, and again, all the notions that we heard before, the subjugation, the history, and so on and so forth, is not true by practice. Mr. Pipes mentioned that you have to pay an additional tax if Islam was applied in America. He misunderstood what I said. A non-Muslim pay a certain tax, and a Muslim pay a certain tax. The non-Muslim tax pays only one dinar, that is $100 per year. He can fight with Mr. Spencer because even Mr. Spencer admitted that in his book. The other aspect of being a Zimmi is to be exempt from Islamic law. He said there's a lot of inequality between women and men in Islam. In inheritance, the 34 potential cases of inheritance, 30 of them the woman inherits the same, more, or the man doesn't inherit whatsoever. The third thing is that you know, Mr. Pipe said that there's so many verses in the Quran, but he would still quote history. And I thank Brother Abdullah for bringing the case of Musa bin Maimun, who is not only considered one of the leading Islamic philosophers, but he wrote the Torah Mishnah, one of the fundamental books of Judaism, in Arabic. That's telling me if that is subjugated or not. And he was the private physician of Salahuddin, the one who defended the Crusaders. One of the brightest examples about that is at the time of the Crusaders that caused the death of 6 million Muslims, no reports whatsoever of local Christians being hurt in retaliation of the aggressions that happened. And I am the first one to admit that the Crusades got nothing to do with the teachings of Jesus, peace be upon him. Again, I want to remind people, it is Palestine that is being occupied and hundreds of thousands and millions of Palestinians killed. It is Iraq that was invaded, causing hundreds of thousands of being killed. So is Afghanistan, so the Bosnia, so in Kashmir. So if you look at the numbers altogether and compare apples to apples, the 16,000 cases of terrorism that Mr. Spencer talks about, that's just half of the death that happened after the invasion of Iraq in 1 month in Iraq. So let's tell people the truth here.
Okay, I don't know how that's comparing apples with apples, though. You're not comparing Islam with Christianity, are you? But anyway, we're running out of time. I want to turn it to Robert for some final comments, sort of summarize tonight's topic for us. Has Islam been hijacked by radicals? Take it away.
No, certainly Islam has not been hijacked by radicals. They present themselves, as I said before, in the Islamic communities as the exponents of true Islam, and they make a whole lot of converts among peaceful Muslims by doing that. These gentlemen never dealt with that. They were busy playing gotcha. You know, the one guy says, well, he said don't use history, and then he uses history. I never said don't use history. I said that Mr. Zayed answered with historical examples when you asked him why Christians were being persecuted today. That's an illegitimate use of history, but that doesn't mean that all uses of history are illegitimate. Mr. Kunde, I believe it is, he asked me for other examples of dimitude, and I didn't get to it because I was busy untangling his other diversions, deceptions, and lies. And so here they are. Non-Muslims in the Islamic State have to wear different dress from the Muslims so that they are not greeted with Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, inadvertently by a Muslim. They must keep to the side of the street, step aside if a Muslim wants to pass. They can't build new houses of worship or repair old ones. They can't build buildings higher than Muslims. They can't hold authority over Muslims. There are many, many other humiliating and discriminatory regulations that they have to submit to in traditional and classical mainstream Islamic law. As far as Maimonides goes, both of these Muslim spokesmen are making a great deal about Maimonides. Unfortunately for them, I have a quote from Maimonides right here where he says this: "You know, my brethren, that on account of our sins, God has cast us in the midst of this people, the nation of Ishmael," that is the Muslims, "who persecute us severely and who devise ways to harm us and to debase us. No nation has ever done more harm to Israel," that is, than the Muslims. So this is the great Maimonides, whom they're touting as being a wonderful example of Islamic tolerance. And Maimonides himself says that no nation has ever persecuted the Jews as fiercely as did the Muslims. And so unfortunately, once again, the light of truth shone upon what they're saying shows that they are engaging in half-truths and diversions in order to bamboozle ignorant people into thinking that Islam is tolerant and peaceful. If they really believed that Islam were tolerant and peaceful, they wouldn't even be on this program arguing with me and Dr. Pipes. They would be out trying to convert their fellow Muslims who believe that Islam is not tolerant or peaceful, who believe that Christians and Jews ought to be subjugated under the rule of Islamic law. They would be out trying to change their minds. The fact that instead they direct their attacks at us speaks volumes in itself about their own intentions, as Dr. Pipes very, very pointedly outlined and articulated before, that they are representing a draconian and intolerant, a radically intolerant belief system that mandates oppression of women and non-Muslims, and that they wish to impose upon the West and to destroy millions of lives thereby by subjugating them under its 7th-century strictures. And all free people, Muslim and non-Muslim, must stand up and resist that.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, we ran out of time this evening. Possibly we can invite our four panelists back onto the program to discuss this some further. I do want to thank all four panelists for joining us this evening.